Okay, welcome everybody. It's great to see you all here. As we said, this is called the New Era, the constructive gift of Catholic tradition. I think we can all recognize that we're living through a period of profound change. People despair of the lack of vision among the political class. Indeed, all governments of the left and the right for decades have gone along with a hyper-liberal and progressivist vision that has, we might say, liberated our culture from tradition, from history, from truth, from community, from family, from responsibility, indeed from God. And as a result, we're facing a meta-crisis, everything going wrong at the same time. Now, surely, only Christ can heal. But can Christianity resource us constructively in political terms? While some extremist Christian and indeed Catholic groups are seeking to weaponize the faith, it is vital that we land on an authentic interpretation if we seek to shape the political economy of the new era, indeed to shape the future of this nation. We are extremely fortunate in England to have Lord Glassman, whose work is unrivaled in recovering the gift of Catholic tradition in political economy. I will introduce Lord Glassman in a moment. We're also extremely blessed to have the vision of Monsignor John Armitage, who will join us in conversation after Lord Glassman's talk. Many of you will know Monsignor John, who's the parish priest of St. Margaret's Church, Canning Town, in East London, where he was born and bred, and I was too, and where he's been priest for 40 years, apart from when he served as rector of the National Basilica of Our Lady of Walsingham, overseeing the rededication of the Dowry of Our Lady. He's also master of the Guild of Our Lady of Ransom, and he's been very closely involved in the conception and realisation of this festival, we believe. And now to Lord Glassman. He's the director of the Common Good Foundation and founder of the Blue Labour Movement. As a life peer in the House of Lords, Morris is actually a key figure in the current battle for Labour's soul, the Labour Party's soul, challenging the leadership to return to its founding principles. And alongside his academic and political work, he's for many years been involved in authentic community organising at the moment in Grimsby. He's also the author of the book Blue Labour, The Politics of the Common Good. So what we're going to do is I'm going to hand over to Lord Glassman now. He's going to speak for about 20 minutes and then Monsignor John and I will be in conversation with him. So over to you.
Thank you. Yeah, that would be useful. Good morning, everybody. I will cut my... There's nothing more important than Latin Mass, so I am aware. Yeah, that's your Mass. This is the Latin Mass. It's a proper Mass, you know, John. It's great to be here. Pope Gregory the First wrote that the primary virtue, the first virtue, is gratitude, and I agree. So first of all, glory be to God, who described himself at Mount Sinai when he stood face to face with Moses as a God of mercy and grace, slow to anger and abounding with kindness and truth. Kindness and truth, not kindness or truth. Ever ancient, ever new, my first gratitude is to God for the enormity of his blessing. I also bow my head in gratitude to the Mother Church, protector of the flame, the burning bush that is never extinguished, the embodiment in this world of kindness and truth. I also wish to express my personal gratitude to the Catholic Church for the gift of Rerum Novarum and the encyclicals which have shaped my ethics, my politics and my life. Ever ancient, ever new. And there's an Augustine here, isn't there? There's an Augustine. There he is. So, just to express my gratitude to both Augustines, really appreciate you turning up. I will always be faithful and grateful for the gift that I've been given. And blessed is the memory of Pope Leo XIII, and blessings to Pope Leo XIV, that he may be true to the name he has chosen. Gratitude to Isaac and John and the organisers for the invitation to speak here. I am an Orthodox Jew and a Labour politician. members of my party were enthusiastic about decriminalising abortion at 9 months, increasing the incentive to urge suicide on your parents, and the government of Israel is raining down missiles on defenceless people in Gaza. I think there were many reasons not to invite me to a convocation committed to the proclamation of the truth of the Catholic Church, ever ancient, ever new. It means a lot to me that you invited me to speak. It is an act of grace. And finally, in this Oscar ceremony, I'd like to express my gratitude to Father John and Jenny Sinclair. Father John has been my teacher, my mentor, or should I say my tormentor, and my friend for more than 20 years. While he tends more to the truth and to kindness in his words to me, I note that this is not the case when he speaks to others. I don't think I've ever refused a request from Father John. My trust in you is unbreakable. And to Jenny, the most faithful pilgrim on her journey through the shadow of the valley of death, even when you can barely walk, you never rest. Only strength and health to you. Glory be to God, Selah. So in a moment of clarity, the late Pope Francis said that we are not living through an era of change, but through a change of era. On this, he was profoundly right. And before I begin to describe the era that is forming now, which I call the era of restoration, it is necessary to describe what it is replacing. It was a period of historical time. We all lived through it. It is our life. It's only just beginning to move. That was mercilessly initiated by Margaret Thatcher in 1979, and you could say immaculately consummated by Tony Blair. And I call this the era of progressive globalization. It was the common sense for 40 years, and its assumptions still dominate our economy and our government. The problem is that no one believes in it anymore. The tragedy for progressives is that the future is not what they thought it was going to be. And the more the future slips away, the more they double down on their greatest weaknesses and follies. The more liberal, the more authoritarian, the more diverse, the more homogeneous of thought. The future is dissolving before their eyes. And so they fight to preserve their power by forcing through legislation based on their values and their beliefs. And the more they do that, the more unpopular they become. And the people have restored their belief. You have restored your belief, and they can't believe it. It defies belief. The truth is not kind for them, and it is very hard for me not to relish in their discomfort, but I'm obliged to at least try. I don't always live up to that. And this age of restoration is paradoxical. It is dark and light, loving and hateful, violent and holy, fearful and hopeful. Let me try to explain by way of contrast the scale of the transformation we are living through. The old era was contractual. The new era is covenantal. The old era was characterized by the domination of financial services, in which money became the ultimate measure of value, whereas the new requires industry and a priority for national security. Free movement will be replaced by borders, corporate social responsibility by national economic strategy, innovation by invention, reform by restoration, process by courage, diversity by solidarity. Most importantly, the old era was progressive. Do you remember things can only get better? Do you remember things can only get better? The least true thing you've ever heard in your life is things can only get better. And the new era, the emerging era, is tragic. The previous era was procedural, legal and administrative. The new era will be political, democratic and volatile. Looked at from a certain angle, Father John, it's a shift from Protestant to Catholic. That's one way of viewing the shift, from individualism to institutions, from self-definition to the authority of tradition, ever ancient, ever new. The election of Donald Trump, I believe, was the final confirmation of the end of the old era, which has been brewing for 2 decades. But we are only at the beginning. We are only just emerging from the fog of progress, in which up is down, bad is good, weird is normal, human rights mean you can't tell the truth, justice is the defense of corporations, democracy is liberalism, sovereignty is obedience to multinational treaties, freedom means compliance, creativity is marketing, and diversity is homogeneity. Two generations have been sacrificed to this idiocy masquerading as reason, and universities have been the main incubators. And by the way, men are women, and Islam is a religion of peace. And if you don't agree, we'll take away your lanyard and you won't have a job, honestly. So this fantasy is over, and the truth is kind. Only our delusions make us tremble. It enables me to say to you, without fear of being called nostalgic or outdated, that the first point ever ancient, ever new, is that the free market did not create the world. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, and this is the first sentence of Holy Scripture. Without following Aquinas too closely, we can define creation as human beings and nature. The definition of capitalism is the commodification of both. The exploitation of human beings and nature in order to turn them into commodities of fluctuating price in competitive markets, that's what capitalism is. Pope Leo XIII called this a system of modern slavery, and St. John Paul II called it a structure of sin. It desecrates the human status of the worker. The highest return at the greatest speed is its objective, and the status of a worker limits that return. Capitalism is like diarrhea, it liquidates the blockage. The second truth is that the state did not create the world either. The preservation of the sacred status of human beings and nature is the primary role of politics. Subsidiarity is the best way to temper the pharaonic tendency of centralized power. Sovereignty is necessary to resist the domination of capital. Subsidiarity is required to resist the tyranny of the state. And all of this is predicated on democratic solidarity as the fundamental ethic of society. Cain made a very big mistake. He was his brother's keeper, and we all are. So this is basically the position of Blue Labour in British politics, and it is based entirely on Laborum Exercens and Centesimus Annus. I have already said thank you. I will do it again. So the fundamental teaching of Catholic social thought is that tyranny is a real threat in the economy and in the state, and that only a Christian democracy, founded upon solidarity, the sharing of the burdens of this hard and merciless life, can generate a virtuous politics through domesticating the demonic energy of capitalism and the state. Solidarity, status, and subsidiarity are the three pillars. That is why I argue, and you can deal with it at Latin Mass, I think. That is why I argue, as a Jew and an Orthodox one, that in politics Christ is King, that in honouring the name of God we honour his creation incarnated, that the attributes God gave to himself when he spoke face to face with Moses on Mount Sinai are the very condition of citizenship: mercy, grace, kindness and truth. This is why secular republics fail. It is not only that they yearn for a king, but they reject the very idea of nobility that is essential for virtue, ever ancient, ever new. Trump's inauguration was a very interesting experience. They are yearning for a king over there and for an aristocracy, and all they have is Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos. There are many rich people, but very little nobility. So when God described himself to Moses as a God of mercy and grace, slow to anger, and a God of enormous kindness and truth, this is the paradox of God, for the truth is not kind. It tends to hurt one's feelings. In order to be kind, however, we must honor the truth. And in order to honor God, we must honor his creation and recognize the truth that the last 35 years have been a desecration of all that is sacred. Pope Leo XIII and Pope John Paul II understood this better than anyone, even better than Marx, who wrote that in capitalism all that is holy is profaned and everything solid melts into air. The gift of Catholic social teaching speaks to us now as clearly as God spoke at Mount Sinai, ever ancient, ever new. We are not commodities. We are not administrative units, but we are social beings yearning for love and meaning. Solidarity, subsidiarity, and the dignity of labour are the foundations of the encyclicals. There has never been a greater need for the Catholic Church as the leading moral force in the restoration of our nation. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Maurice. That was fantastic. I'd like to turn to Monsignor John now. Would you like to give us your response to the talk? In particular, thinking about the context of the rededication of the Diary of Our Lady and the future of England and of our nation.
First, I have to explain how I met this man.
Don't do it, yeah.
So I had a phone call and saying, could he come and see me? And we were talking about a whole range of things. He actually wanted to talk to me about the reform of the City of London. I still don't know why, but, you know. But at the end of the conversation, I said to Maurice, much of what you're saying sounds like Catholic social teaching. And at the time, you were head of politics at Metropolitan University, weren't you? And so you said you'd heard of it, but, you know, tell me a bit more about it. So I gave him the social encyclicals, and he took them off. And I want you to go forward 10 years, OK? When he phones me up and he says, John, what's a papal nuncio? I said, it's the Pope's ambassador. What does he want to see me for? I said, well, I doubt he's going to make you a bishop, Maurice. And so he goes up to the nunciature and is given a letter from Pope Francis asking him to come and give the keynote speech at the centenary of Centissimus Annus, one of the encyclicals. And that's the sort of the distance that we've come. It's a remarkable distance. If you get the chance, ask Maurice about his visit to Iraq. That's a very funny one, you know, but not for now.
We've got a Latin.
Yeah. So that's how we've met over the years. We've been good friends, but we have talked. I know that you cannot smoke on the terrace of the House of Lords, okay? But you can on the House of Commons. And that's where he lives most of the time. Uh-huh. And his office actually is an ashtray out on the terrace. Uh-huh. Eccentric is not the word, but eccentric in the sense that it's difficult to put Maurice in any box at all, apart from he is Maurice Glassman, which is absolutely unique. And his understanding of our society, I have seen, as we talk through so many issues, you sit with him out there on the terrace in Parliament, and you really can't have a conversation because so many people will come up and say, Maurice this, Maurice that, can I speak to you about this, etc. There is a wisdom that he has discovered which is based in the Judeo-Christian foundation of our country, and he is one of the most articulate people in bringing that strength out. And it's something that we desperately need at this moment. One of the things I think that struck both of us when Pope Francis gave that speech to the Italian church, and he said, we're not living in an era of change, we are living in a change of era. Well, it really struck me, and it's knocked him for six. Because since then, it's been a sort of not a framework, but it's been a sort of a focus.
And we're here now.
And it's here. This change that we are living through, and this foundation of the things that is ever ancient, ever new, it does not change. It is something upon which we can build.
Yeah.
Now, looking at my parish,
Hanningtown,
if you've not heard of it, you should have done. So, many years ago, we were looking at the issues that were being faced with the building of Canary Wharf. The Canary Wharf was built on the old docks, and the docks closed, and all the work on the docks and on the river closed with it. And we were looking and to try and see what could happen, how we could make a difference. And what we recognised was the incredible parallels between the great dock strike of the 1880s, 1889, thank you, and the conditions and the working conditions of the people then, and how the communities that were there in 1889 were still there at this time. They were still there. And the similarities were quite remarkable. And we started to look and to see, and with community organising, to try and help to understand how the challenges of then are the challenges of today, but updated. And so this was how our relationship built. And Morris has been this sometimes lone voice, but the sort of voice that when people say, oh, that's it, come and listen, it really does make sense. So I think we are very fortunate to have him as a real friend of the church. You know, a real friend of the church. He talks about Jesus all the time, mainly because he was Jewish. You know, he's a little bit biased in that way.
Yeah,
you know,
I've got Jesus preference for that reason.
Yeah. So we've managed to have this good working relationship and talk about many of the big issues, but all deeply rooted in this common foundation of Catholic social teaching, which, although it's Catholic, in the sense of it's Catholic universal, it speaks to the world. So that's where it all started.
Great. I would just love you to speak a little bit about the rededication of England and how politics fits into that, because that's largely been a sort of evangelistic vision. I think most people at this festival would see it such. How do you say, Monsignor John, the politics fits into the faith tradition?
Well, politics is just about the way we live and the way we regulate the way we live. So, you know, people say, I'm not interested in politics. Well, you should be. It's the way we, you know, if you're not interested in politics, everyone can, you know, drive on the same side of the road. There'll be crashes and all sorts. So politics is really important. Now, the rededication was recognising that the foundation of British society, in fact, is the Catholic faith. Mm-hmm. Right? If you look at the uniqueness of the contribution of Catholic life to British society, you have to start with history. You can talk about the dock strike of 1889, and that's a bit of history, but you've actually got to go back to Augustine.
Yep.
You've actually got to go back to the Roman occupation. You've got to go back to Alban.
And the parish system.
And the parish system that came from the monasteries, and the parochial system. Parochial is that comes from the parish, from the establishment of the monasteries. Where does the word, where do hospitals come from? It comes from the rule of St. Benedict. The rule of St. Benedict talks about hospitality. If you go to a monastery, you will be given care. And that was the care system up to the Reformation. That's why the Reformation destroyed social care. And it was years later than when the charitable system sort of came along.
To the 19th century.
19th century. And so the greatness of our foundation, of the British identity, the Catholic identity, the English identity, goes right the way back. You cannot understand our country unless you recognise that. And no matter how much we might put it apart, it's essentially who we are. The rededication was to help us in some ways to connect to that truth, to see how important that element of the history of this country, not just element, but the very foundation of it.
Thank you. We might actually ask the question, you know, what is Christian social mission and how can it be achieved? And I think what Maurice, you're doing is helping us to answer that question. I'm just going to give you a couple of minutes to respond to what Monsignor John's been saying, and then I'm going to open it up for questions.
I'm very aware of the Latin Mass, everybody. Oh, they've gone. They didn't even. Oh, great. Okay. But they could have said goodbye. You know. This is the times that we're moving into. This is what I think, Father John, is the resurrection of the church is necessary for the restoration of the nation. It's these things. The first of all is that human life is sacred, that there's a desecration, and this desecration has been institutional and ideological for about 50 years. If you didn't just go for the money, what were you? You were just an idiot. That's the prevailing culture. And then this removal of Christian faith from the public language and also institutionally. I mean, I come from Stamford Hill, you were saying earlier. In Homerton Hospital, you know, to be a Muslim or a Jew is absolutely fine, but to be a Christian, that's strange. You know, that's suddenly extremist. And on this, you know, I said that Christ is king. Politically, Christ is king. He's got to be the lodestar. And we cannot concede Christ is king to nutcases and fanatics. It's absolutely necessary to state that those things, righteousness, mercy, compassion and truth are, and we've lost, the biggest thing we've lost is the capacity to speak the truth. This is what I was trying to say. In order to get on, maybe in any career other than the priesthood, John, you had to sign up to a whole load of nonsense. You had to stay silent when you should speak. You had to then be compelled to speak. Anybody been to a work-away day? Has anybody had this experience? It's like you're forced to say and do things that are completely wrong, you know. And the greatness about this moment, and I know it's fearful, people are very fearful, there's huge anger in the society. This anger needs to be heard, I think, John. I mean, we need to bear witness to that, to all of that, and not be afraid, not to stand trembling, because the old era is really rotten. So let's just talk about restoration just for a minute, Jenny, because that's where I think we're heading. What people long for is the restoration of good order. This was always a fundamental thing. So they want effective government, and they don't want endless procedure and admin. They want the government, I'm always saying it, to do something, you know, as opposed to create another commission, another investigation. They want to know the reason why things don't work, and that will lead, I think, Father John. So let's look at this. It is officially, statistically, the case that 35% of 18 to 30-year-olds are disabled. This cannot, I'm just sharing with you, it cannot be true. It just cannot be true. You know, I'm tired of I say it in Parliament, I'll tell you what's a vulnerable person. A vulnerable person is a 9-month-old baby about to be born. That's a vulnerable person. Not someone on a personal independence budget who's perfectly capable of walking around and indeed watch the television. So we've got, that's what I meant about the truth. We've got to be able to tell the truth. And what I think, just to finish off, Jenny, is that the Catholic Church is institutionally, politically in the space that can lead this, because it's not yet entirely captured by progressivism. It still can say there is a difference between a man and a woman. It can still say that love between a man and a woman is the most sacred thing in this society. It can still say that your family matters, and it can still say that grace and mercy are vital in your understanding of the world. The Catholic Church is in the greatest period since the Reformation to assert its Christian leadership of the nation, And because it is an international church, it's not going to be a nasty nationalist church. It's just not going to be that way. But it can still speak for the truth. And, you know, that's the neglected story in Labour history. If you read all the academic stories, it's all about Methodism and it's all about the nonconformists. If you look at the actual data, the vast majority of working class members were Catholic. And that's just needs to be rediscovered. Many things more, but...
Okay, just to say, we're going to run till just before 1:15. We've been allowed to run over a little. And Maurice will be around having lunch. We'll find somewhere out here to have lunch. So, and smoking and lunch. So if you have a burning question that there isn't time for now, you can come and find us. But we do have time, I would say, for two, maximum three questions. And they've got to be really short and clear. Okay, you're the first to have your hand up. Second. Right, one and two. We'll start with you.
Thank you both for a really interesting talk.
What's your name?
Colby.
So you
said that the root of the nation is in Catholicism, or the root of Britain is in Catholicism. In terms of, like, arguing for who's going to win the fight for the Restoration, from a more historical point of view, how would you convince people that the root is Catholicism and not say, oh, it was Protestantism or the Reformation that made England... Really,
okay, how would you convince that the root is Catholicism and not from the Reformation?
Well, if I start, I wouldn't.
Yeah, exactly.
I wouldn't, because I think if, you know, let's look at evangelization. Can anyone convince you to believe anything? Not really, you know. What happens is evangelization arises when in another person they give the answer to your question. You know? So if you're not looking, you're not going to find it. You know? Seek and you shall find. Knock and the door will be open to you. But you've got to seek, you've got to knock, you've got to look. And you don't do that unless you realise you're lost. And because we live in a society that is basically controlled by anaesthetics of just about every shape and form, people don't think they're lost. Until one day something happens. So I think the church is there not to enforce its belief, but it's to live the truth. So when that moment comes in a person's life and they say, there must be more to life than this. Well, I was a vocations director for years, and because where I live is right next to the city, many of the people I spoke to would be people who'd made lots of money in the city, been really successful. And then one day they realised it was all just a stack of nothing. And the common phrase was, there must be more to life than this. And when you come to that point, what you'll find is the Catholic Church, ever ancient, ever new. So I think it's not us convincing, it is us living faithfully, and when someone looks, they'll find.
Yeah, and it's, there's also a matter of strategy in that. What I've found, look, we shouldn't... I was talking about not being gloating about the discomfort of progressives. I urge you not to gloat overly, if you can bear it, about the discomfort of Protestants, because it is it's disintegrating, this excessive individualism, this direct relationship, the ignoring of societal institutions, the eternal truth of Augustine. This is so, in a way, you don't need to say it, it's just happening. The important thing is that the church is in a position of leadership to be heard. So the difficult thing I'm saying to the church, and said it for a long time, whatever you do, don't talk about sex. No one's listening to that side of the equation. Talk about life, talk about the economy, talk about how society is. Because that's where the enormous strength of the tradition lies.
Yeah, I think it's really important that we, as Catholics, don't take a triumphalist position on this. Protestants are actually increasingly interested in Catholic social thought. I find that in my work. We've got a second question over here.
Leadership and what they should be talking about. It would be interesting to hear what you think we, the Catholic laity and the here, should be doing to do politics, and particularly you're saying it's kind of moment for doing politics, it's a moment for doing democracy rather than the assumption that liberalism is democracy. Okay, that means it's a moment for argument, for debate, for conversation, but how do we kind of not win those debates, but lead those conversations without getting into bed with the kind of factions you alluded to who are too extreme in one direction or another.
Okay, so how should Catholic laity become involved in politics, basically?
Makes John drink. Look, this is your calling now. I mean, so the first thing I'm saying to you is don't be timid. And I would say don't get involved in party politics in that straightforward way, because it's decomposing and reforming. I mean, that's a space for that. But it's above all restoring a practice of conversation with neighbours, and then having brokering and hosting forms of public conversation about things that people care about. So immigration, it would be fantastic if the Catholic laity could host local conversations in which the anger of the people who don't want the immigrants, as well as the virtuousness of those people who do, is heard. This is the crucial, is to hold that. And the second thing is just the ancient practice of one-to-one conversation. Just meet the people around you, talk to the people. That is politics. That is where you discover your political calling as well, if you have one. I mean, that's what we used to do. We just used to sit around talking to people, and at the end of the day, I won't tell you exactly the language that John used, but it was something along the lines of, core. That was interesting. But that's the experience that shaped me. Like I thought that all you had to do was make an argument and everybody would go, oh. But then you've got to, relationships before action. It's always the priority of relationship. And that's the hard work. It's the time spent, you know, if you just go and act like a lawyer and make arguments to people, they don't listen. So the laity are the key. But that's your self-organisation has got to come in, and you've got to find your distinctive way of being the Catholic laity. And my real suggestion to you is you don't get involved in the internal church politics, you engage with the people with whom you live. That's the right thing.
One of the things that strikes me at the moment is this so-called epidemic of mental illness.
Oh, yeah.
You know? It seems to be absolutely everywhere. Now, the point is, I think there's a lot of misdiagnosis.
I know.
Now, when I go back to my youth and I was brought up by people who were dodging bombs for a long time in the East End. And almost nobody ever spoke about mental illness. I'm not saying it wasn't there, but what they were talking about was the stress of life. How did they cope with the stress of life? They coped with the stress of life through faith, family, friendship, neighbours, sense of belonging. I think to be involved in any, if you're not rooted and know your local community, and many politicians haven't got a clue, then it's very difficult to speak with authority.
Thank you. We're going to have to wrap up, but I just want to leave you with this, that my work at Together for the Common Good directly responds to your question on the role of the laity and how we should respond to these times. So if you're interested, please go to togetherforthecommongood.co.uk or t4cg@substack.com. I'd just like to thank Monsignor John and Maurice for this great session. And I would ask you to pray for Maurice. I do believe that he's called to this work, as am I, as is Monsignor John, and all of you here. Everyone is called to contribute to the common good. It's part of our vocation. And I would just like to, you know, bless Maurice in his work. So would you just sort of join with me, just quietly in your heart, just pray for Maurice. And do come and find me and my stall in the Café Marquis if you're interested to talk further. And we'll be having lunch and a cigarette outside here. If you want to find us, I think until about...
Cigarette and lunch.
Up till about 2:30. I think you've got to leave at 2:30. Is that right? So he's off to Ukraine again. What, the 14th time, I think, 15th time. But thank you, everybody. This has been a great session. Thank you.
Huge thanks again to this fantastic panel. Oh, yeah.